But things that make us uncomfortable are always a rich source of humor. Few things, I think, make us more uncomfortable than having someone, or usually some two people, show up at our front door and offer us an opportunity to change our religion. To change from ours to theirs, that is. So here are a few of the many comic responses that people have come up with to help deal with the stress of such a situation. The first is a simple suggestion. You ready? Answer the door naked and carrying weaponry. This is supposed to guarantee immediate results, like Mrs. Nosh and her squash. I imagine that it would work. The next one would take longer, but it should prove just as effective. Pretend to be the slowest talking person in the world and see how long their spirit of Christian charity lasts. The next one should also work. Excuse yourself from the front door for a moment and do not come back. The problem is that if it didn't work, you could find yourself stuck with some very cold and frustrated evangelist still huddling there when you go off to work the next morning. So here's a couple more suggestions. Answer every one of their questions with, "What do you mean by that?" This might take a while, but you and your loved ones can have fun placing bets on how long it takes for them to get flustered and leave. Or, and I like this one, pick an oft-repeated word in their vocabulary. God, Jesus, heaven, it, the, etc. And giggle whenever they utter it. If they ask you what's going on, say, "Nothing. Why?" In very even tones, and then giggle again. Or, instead of giggling, say beep at each cue word. Giggle or beep. Now, this next one could also be adapted for secular phone solicitors. Tell them you're busy at the moment and ask them if they will give you their home phone number so you can call them back. When they explain that they cannot give out their home number, you say, "I guess you don't want anyone bothering you at your home, right?" They will agree, and you say, "Now you know how I feel," and close the door. But for now, let's open our hymnals to hymn number 368 and sing, "Now Let Us Sing." I remember visiting going to the GA in Little Rock, Arkansas, and hearing the Unitarians from that part of the country sing, from Oklahoma and Arkansas, and they just sang like birds. They just sang like birds. So we could sing, you could sure sing. Well, okay, I don't want to shock your system by transitioning too quickly from jokes about missionaries to a serious talk about the mission of our own church. So here are a couple more. You can tell that I'm getting down to religious business now because I start to name names. Why are there no Jehovah's Witnesses or Mormons in heaven? It's not that they don't deserve it. It's because whenever they show up at the pearly gates, God pulls St. Peter under his desk and says, "Shh, pretend we're not here." And finally, one that you might have heard already, maybe on a public radio show like Prairie Home Companion, though I won't name any names. What do you get when you cross a Mormon with a Unitarian Universalist? Yes, that's one answer. Great, site-specific answer. But a non-site-specific answer is someone who knocks on your door for no particular reason. And that's always a common theme in Garrison Keillor's UU jokes, that we're vague, have no purpose or mission of our own. But now I've got a question. What do you actually say when such folks show up at your home, all full of smiles and sunshine? Would you like to share just a bit of your strategy for the benefit of us, a couple people? Yes?
If a Mormon missionary show up at my door and I answer the door, I want to say, just a moment, I'll go get my spouse, and then bring Denise with me.
There you go. This will often be a former LDS member speaking.
Well, I operate by Unitarian Universalism.
And you wear them down. That's wonderful. Yes?
I tell them that if I'm willing to go to their church, they should come to mine.
Okay, very good. Tit for tat. Very good. Okay. One more? Yes, Gary?
I invite them in and engage them in as much of a discussion as they're willing to have.
Oh, what a kindly what a kindly man. The flowered shirt says it. Oh, we got to have one more. Yeah, two more. Go ahead.
Jehovah's Witnesses, you might ask them who Judge Rutherford was.
Ah, okay. Yes, yes. A very educated man. And whatever happened? Frank?
I'm not as welcoming. I say I'm a Unitarian, and there's a very, very long step from you to me.
Thank you. Although Jehovah's Witnesses are little U Unitarians. Many people don't know that. Well, I once came unintentionally close to enacting that very first option that I shared with you this morning. Do you remember that one? Answer the door naked and carrying weaponry. When my wife and I were graduate students, we lived near a Jehovah's Kingdom Hall, and I guess our block was used for training witnesses. So many of them came that I prepared this very serious, detailed religious tract so that I could hand mine to them before they could give me theirs. And one morning, the doorbell rang when I'd just gotten out of the shower, so I bounded to the door wearing only a towel, looking like a wet Charles Manson with my long hair and beard dripping. I bent down to get one of my tracts from behind the door and said, "Wait, I've got something for you." While Pam stood behind, she later told me that they had frozen with terror on their faces, sure that I was going for a gun. I laughed, but I wasn't really pleased. I only wanted to confront this practice of two or more people ganging up on one. You know, usually one person who wasn't expecting them. Two or more people who are all warmed up, getting the jump on one who's not. That seems a little bit like bullying. But I didn't mean to bully in return. They came prepared to invade my religious space, and I prepared a response. I told you all about this in an earlier sermon a few years ago. But nowadays, when such folk come to my door, I usually say something very simple like, "Sorry, I'm a minister of another faith tradition, and I need to get back to work on my sermon." That plus the white beard does the trick just as well as those wild Charles Manson's looks and my elaborate tract ever did. Probably better. So answer the door naked and carrying weaponry. If my homemade tract was anything like a weapon, I meant it purely for defense. It was not something that I would ever dream, though, of taking to other people's doorsteps in a missionary way. I would feel really naked trying to do that. And maybe that's why so many people who do it have adopted a uniform of sorts. White shirts with black ties and name badges that identify a fresh-faced kid as an elder, as if he had the longest, whitest beard of all. Or sharp clothes and leather briefcases that make folks with a high school education or less look like lawyers or doctors or professors, people with a serious job to do. And they are serious about certain religious ideas and stories and experiences. But it's not enough for them that they and their fellow church members feel it. They want you to feel it too. They need you to feel it, accept it, and believe it, just like they do, like your life depends on it. If you were going to go door to door to share the liberal message of this church, what would you wear? I like the standing on the love side of love t-shirts, but one good choice might be to dress like Thomas Jefferson. You have to admit that those cool revolutionary era clothes would have a sort of nifty unisex look today. You know, the tri-cornered hat, the legging things and the ruffles and all that. But wasn't Jefferson himself extremely cautious about any one religious view holding sway in this new country he'd helped to design? Wasn't he the one who wrote some famous words to a group of religious dissenters who were struggling to free themselves from an obligation to support the Anglican Church of Virginia when they weren't Anglicans themselves? Here's what he wrote in that letter, very famous letter. Believing with you that religion is a matter which lies solely between man and his God, that he owes account to none other for his faith or his worship, that the legitimate powers of government reach actions only and not opinions, I contemplate with sovereign reverence that act of the whole American people which declared that their legislature should make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof, thus building a wall of separation between church and state. Yes, he really said those words. Those are his words, as applied to any attempt to force Americans to adopt the practices or beliefs of one religious system set above all others. But was it possible for any religious principles to be so compelling in their own right that everyone would simply adopt them on their own? Let me share some less well-known words of Jefferson's. Here he is reflecting on the orthodox doctrine of the Trinity, that God is to be worshipped as three distinct persons, Father, Son, Holy Spirit. For centuries, those who challenged this idea had met with persecution, imprisonment, torture, and death. But the game had changed in this new nation, and the growing Unitarian movement was actively challenging the orthodox view. And Jefferson reflected that the hocus-pocus phantasm of a God like another Cerberus with one body and three heads had its birth and growth in the blood of thousands and thousands of martyrs, and a strong proof of the solidity of the primitive faith, meaning one God without elaboration into three parts, is its restoration as soon as a nation arises which vindicates to itself the freedom of religious opinion and its external divorce from civil authority. That man could write some long sentences. That was one sentence. Well, so far, that's what we would expect from the author of the 1786 Virginia Statute of Religious Freedom, which became a model for our Constitution's First Amendment. But now in 1822, he adds that the pure and simple unity of the Creator of the universe is now all but ascendant in the eastern states. It's dawning in the west and advancing toward the south, and I confidently expect that the present generation will see Unitarianism become the general religion of the United States. Not the official, but the general religion. Later that year, he added in a letter to a friend, I rejoice that in this blessed country of free inquiry and belief, which has surrendered its conscience to neither kings nor priests, the genuine doctrine of only one God is reviving, and I trust that there is not a young man now living in the United States who will not die a Unitarian. What foresight he had. And I trust that he would include women, too, if he were speaking today. But I wonder what he would identify as the great ideas or teachings of our time that will pull us all together as one. I don't think that affirming God as one in one instead of one in three would still capture people's imaginations the way it did back then. The freedom to think or speak about God any way you want to or not at all still holds the interest of many, especially those who live in parts of this country or the world where such freedom is not yet fully enjoyed. But what's the religious good news that he might find worthy of sharing on the streets, door to door, or anywhere we go? Well, now, like I've done so many times before, I invite you to look at the back of your order of service. Usually I ask you to read something there silently to yourself, but today I'd like to do something different, something that we did in our mission workshop. I'll start by reading the introduction to those seven principles that you see at the top of the page. And then I'd like one volunteer to read the first, another to read the second, and so on through all seven. Next, let's do the same for the sources, and then I'll do the blessing at the end. Does that sound okay? Okay, let's start. I'll begin. We, the member congregations of the Unitarian Universalist Association, covenant to affirm and promote
the inherent worth and dignity of every person,
justice, equity, and compassion in human relations,
acceptance of one another, and encouragement to spiritual growth in our congregations,
a free and responsible search for truth and meaning,
the right of conscience, and the use of the democratic process within our congregation and the society at large.
The goal of world community with peace, liberty, and justice for all.
Respect for the independence of all existence of which we are a part.
The living tradition which we share draws from many sources, and those are?
Direct experience that transcending mystery and wonder, affirmed in all cultures, which moves us to a renewal of spirit and an openness to the forces which create and uphold life.
Words and deeds of prophetic women and men, which challenge us to confront powers and structures of evil with justice, compassion, and the transforming power of love.
Wisdom from the world's religions, which inspire us in our ethical and spiritual life.
Jewish and Christian teachings which call us to respond to God's love by loving our neighbors as ourselves.
Humanist teachings which counsel us to heed the guidance of reason and the results of science and warn us against the idolatries of the mind and spirit.
Spiritual teachings of Earth-centered traditions which celebrate the sacred circle of life and instruct us to live in harmony with the rhythms of nature.
Grateful for the religious pluralism which enriches and ennobles our faith, we are inspired to deepen our understanding and expand our vision. As free congregations, we enter into this covenant, promising to one another our mutual trust and support. Now I want to go backwards a little bit. We've just promised each other our mutual trust and support. But does this mean that I have to value spiritual teachings and earth-centered traditions as much as you do? How about Jewish and Christian teachings which call us to respond to God's love by loving our neighbors as ourselves? Maybe it's gotten too hard for some of us to sort these teachings from Jewish and Christian teachings that seem to teach the opposite. How about direct experience of transcendent mystery and wonder when the whole mystical thing has never done a thing for me with my 2 feet planted squarely on the ground? No problem, right? As long as we treat each other with respect, understanding that different flavors of religious experience are like different kinds of food or music. You like tofu and spinach and fruit. I like sauerbraten and spätzle, though I'm sympathetic to the idea of fresh fruit and fiber. I like rock. And you like opera. Wagnerian opera, for God's sake. Seriously, though, this should not interfere with our sitting or celebrating together. We'll work something out with the food, like we do at our interfaith potlucks. But what about those principles? Are you really comfortable that someone should not respect the inherent worth and dignity of every person, not affirm justice, equity, and compassion in human relations, not support a free and responsible search for truth and meaning, and so on down the list? Are you content for anyone to actively oppose or work against these great, compelling notions? I'm not asking if you would go to war or even door to door to make them change their minds or their behavior. But would you be content? Wouldn't you want to do something to help change their minds? Are these principles really negotiable? I think, we really think, unlike what Garrison Keillor might think, that they're for everyone. not only right here, right now, but everywhere forevermore. I know that I do. I only realized this quite recently. I know that that might seem silly, especially considering what I do for a living, but there you go. I suppose that makes me much less different from those door-to-door knockers than I used to think I was. Those principles represent a vision of the world that I want to live in, painted in 7 broad strokes. A world for everybody. I'll be waiting, praying, talking, singing, voting, and breathing it into being to the best of my ability, with all my limits of strength and courage. Won't you? Don't you hope that Jefferson's prediction comes true and principles like ours really do become the core of the, quote, general religion of the United States, no matter what your religious stripe or denomination? No, I wouldn't want there to be only one kind of church any more than there should be one kind of restaurant. I don't need to see our principles on every menu, but I do think they belong on everyone's plate, presented in an endless variety of dishes. I want people to discover those principles in their own Judaism, Hinduism, Christianity, or Islam, to find them there already. I think they really are there. I hope I can help others to see them too. And that's what a mission means. Doing what you can to bring a vision forward. Did you know that our religious association, like all the churches like this one and the people like you and me, actually has a mission that it has announced to anyone who cares to hear it? It's right there in the front of your hymnal, right after the preface on a page all its own. Those first few pages, you'll see one page with just one paragraph on it. Our neighbor, Bill Sinkford, the minister of Portland Church and the past president of the Unitarian Universalist Association, once asked a big group of us ministers if we'd spent much time reading the purposes of the UUA. Not the principles or the sources, he said. He knew we all loved those. He said, the purposes. Well, I felt my face getting red. Like I just found myself standing naked on a doorstep. I'd seen the words, of course, I glanced at them, but I'd never heard them spoken. And that can make a big difference. That's just what Sinkford did. He read them. The Unitarian Universalist Association shall devote its resources to and exercise its corporate powers for religious, educational, and humanitarian purposes. The primary purpose of the association is to serve the needs of its member congregations, organize new congregations, extend and strengthen Unitarian Universalist institutions, and implement its principles. Did you hear that? Implement its principles. Implement them. Not go to war or even door to door necessarily, but not to just sit back and enjoy the vision like a movie, to be entertained by it or even moved by its beauty. We respond to the vision by waiting, praying, talking, singing, voting, and breathing it into being. We don't just do it alone. We form conspiracies to make it so, this lovely vision that we share. Do you know what it means to conspire? It means to breathe together. So a good congregation conspires to get what it wants. Now, if we want to get religious missionaries off of our doorsteps, I've already shared this suggestion. Here it comes again. Pick an often repeated word in their vocabulary: God, Jesus, heaven, it, the, etc. and giggle whenever they utter it. Or instead of giggling, say beep at each Q word. But if we're going to dish it out, we better also be able to take it. Except that our principles and sources don't use the word it, ha-ha, even once. Same for Jesus and heaven. They do use the word the 20 times and of 19, but those are silly choices. You're all very silly. There's only one God there. Hallelujah. One God. Did I just say that? One God. Hallelujah. Well, that was the central Unitarian teaching in Jefferson's time, so now the word one is just used twice. The same is for compassion. Justice comes three times. So does teaching. But after these, what will get the most beeps or giggles? Any guesses? How about we times five? Or us times seven? Seven. How about that? You think that was an accident? All that we and us talk? Or maybe a conspiracy? Did you just think that you could do it all on your own? Do you want to be part of that conspiracy and help to move it forward? If so, feel free to beep or giggle. Beep.